Well, imagine if you were, if you went to the gas pump one day and they charged you $2 a gallon for gallons that measured as only 14 cups. And then you went to another gas station and they charged you $2 a gallon, but they measured gallons as only 13 cups. If you didn't know the difference, you'd be cheated and not know it. If you did know it, how would you be able to hold the merchants accountable if you think gallons should contain 16 cups? The Levites in the temple of Jerusalem were entrusted with maintaining their nation's standards of weights and measurement. And governments still today recognize the importance of having a national standard. Otherwise, it becomes economic chaos. It's fascinating as we see some detail the character of God, who you would think God wouldn't care so much about the value of physical things. A God that can create anything just by speaking, you would think he would consider physical things pretty cheap and unimportant because it was so easy for him to create. But we see, nevertheless, he created a justice system that includes fairness down to small details like standards of weights and measures. It gives us one more reason to believe that God does care about everything he created. He cares about you and every detail of your life. As we look at chapter 27, it opens like this. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, if a man is solemnizing a vow with your arrangement to buy back persons who've been given over to Yahweh, when your arrangement is for a male from the age of 20 years up to the age of 60 years, then your arrangement shall be 25 ounces of silver, using the sanctuary's ounce weight. But if it is for a female, then your arrangement shall be 15 ounces. If, however, one is from the age of 5 years up to the age of 10 years, then your arrangement shall be for a male 10 ounces, for a female 6 ounces. And if one is from the age of a month up to the age of 5 years, then your arrangement shall be for a male 2.5 ounces of silver. For a female, your arrangement will be 1.5 ounces of silver. And if one is from the age of 60 years and up, if a male, the arrangement shall be 7.5 ounces, for a female, 5 ounces. Now, if he's too poor for your arrangement, then he shall cause that one to stand before the face of the priest, and the priest shall make an arrangement concerning him. On the basis of what the employment of the one vowing can afford, the priest shall make arrangements for him." Now, justice and fairness might not be the first things that we as modern Americans think of when we read a passage like this. In fact, it seems quite offensive for God to put price tags on people, especially for God to value women at only 3/5 of the value of men. What on earth is going on here? Well, I think if we look closely at the wording here, there are some things to note. One important thing to recognize is that Leviticus 27 is not describing a slave auction. The last three Hebrew words in verse 2 are key to understanding what this is about. Ba'arekuk nefeshot la'adonai. The NAS renders it according to your valuation of persons belonging to the Lord. So this is about persons who belong to the Lord. They've been given to God for God to own. The NIV is a little more paraphrastic, but it explains more clearly. This is about giving an equivalent value for a person dedicated to the Lord. My translation also had to add some words here that are not in the Hebrew to make sense in English. It's about your arrangement to buy back souls that had been given over to the Lord. Back in chapter 5, we ran into this phrase, according to your valuation or with your arrangement. And it was related to guilt offerings. You did something wrong, and an evaluation had to be made of what you had to pay back in order to make it right. And I mentioned there were three interpretations of where that evaluation would come from. The word your is attached to the Hebrew word for valuation or arrangement in Hebrew. So perhaps it indicates that it's the supplicant's own evaluation of what he thinks is worth of the holy thing that they misused. It also seems from the context of this chapter that the priest, you know, you stand the person or the animal before the priest, and the priest makes an evaluation of what this animal's worth or what should be paid in order to buy back this animal that had been previously given to the Lord. It's also been suggested that the priest's evaluation was based not so much on the value of the person or the animal, but on what he thought that person could pay who wanted to buy that person or animal back. These persons that have been given over to the Lord, or animals that have been given over to the Lord, or things given over to the Lord, are what is being described in Leviticus 27. There's kind of a parallel passage in Numbers 18 that explains more of the context of this, and I want to read that to you at some length to give more context here. In Numbers 18, the Lord spoke to Aaron, saying, I myself have also given you charge of my raised offerings and of all the holy gifts of the children of Israel. I've given them as a portion to you and your sons, as an ordinance forever. So these are offerings from the people of Israel given to the priests. Every devoted, verse 14, every devoted thing in Israel shall be yours. Everything that first opens the womb of all flesh, which they bring to the Lord, whether man or beast, shall be yours. Nevertheless, the firstborn of man you shall certainly redeem, and the firstborn of unclean animals you shall redeem. And those redeemed of the devoted things you shall redeem, when 1 month old, according to your valuation, for 5 shekels of silver, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, which is 20 gerahs. But the firstborn of a cow, the firstborn of a sheep, firstborn of a goat, you shall not redeem. They are holy. You shall sprinkle their blood on the altar and burn their fat as an offering made by fire for a sweet aroma to the Lord. And their flesh shall be yours, the priests, just as the wave breast and the right thigh are yours. All the heave offerings of the holy things which the children of Israel offer to the Lord, I have given to you, Aaron, and your sons and daughters with you as an ordinance forever. It's a covenant of salt forever before the Lord with you and your descendants after you. Then the Lord said to Aaron, you shall have no inheritance in their land, nor shall you have any portion among them. I am your portion and your inheritance among the children of Israel. And behold, I've given the children of Levi all the tithes in Israel as an inheritance in return for the work which they perform, the work of the tabernacle of meeting. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak thus to the Levites and say to them, when you take from the children of Israel the tithes, which I've given you from them as your inheritance, then you shall offer up a heave offering of it to the Lord, a tenth of the tithe. So these things which are given to the Lord were a way of supporting the priests, the Levites, who lived among the people of Israel and served in the worship leadership. This passage, in Hebrew, the unit of measurement is shekel. So most of your English versions will call it a shekel. That's been estimated at half an ounce. So the average arrangement or valuation we're talking about is a pound of silver for a woman or a pound and a half of silver for a man. I think in our current market, that'd be about $300 to $500. But scholars tell us 50 shekels was several years' wages at the time of this writing, and that it was about average for the purchase of a slave in that day and age as well. So is this what God thinks you're worth? $400, $300. Is that all you're worth? And should it cost less to redeem a woman or a child? Aren't their souls of equal value to God? Doesn't the New Testament say there's no distinction between male and female? Aren't our souls really of practically infinite value? It took the eternal Son of God's death to pay for your soul. So what's going on here? Verse 8 offers us a clue, I think. This is important. Since the dollar amount could be dropped for someone who was too poor to afford the standard price for buying someone back who'd been devoted to God, the point of this exercise must not have been to fix an absolute value on the worth of that human soul or that animal. The point of it was rather to recognize God's ownership over that soul, while at the same time encouraging the practice of redeeming that soul by making it affordable and not making it and not tying it to an absolute value. Because these prices are buyback amounts that are evaluated at the level of affordability and not absolute valuations of the worth, then the lower the price, what is incentivized? Buying back is incentivized, right? The lower the price, the more buying back is incentivized. It shows a value on God wanting these people to be redeemed. Viewed in that light, the lower buyback prices for women and children and the elderly can be seen not in terms of them being less valuable, but rather in terms of God finding it more valuable that they be redeemed. Therefore, God sets prices that encourage people to buy them back, to buy back their women and children and their elderly folks so that they could keep them in their family, in their home. Now we see pagan religious systems that turn that on its head, right? The Aphrodite worship in New Testament Corinth, while that incentivized sending your girls to the temple, not keeping them at home. And in our culture, we get it turned around too. We say we can't afford to keep a wife at home, so she needs to go out and get a job. We say we don't have the resources to raise our own children, so we put them in daycare. We say we can't care for our old folks, so we put them away in nursing homes. Do you see how this value on the family comes through here, even in the way God sets redemption values in the Old Testament law? He is encouraging bringing the family together, encouraging the household economy. In the next two sections of Leviticus 27, we see similar rules for buying back animals or real estate that's been dedicated to God. Starting in verse 9, now if it was an animal, some of which they offer as an offering to the Lord, all that one gives from such to the Lord will become holy. One may not change it out or make exchange for it, good for bad or bad for good. And if one really does exchange an animal for an animal, it will come to pass that both it and its exchange will become holy. You can't have either of them then. They both will belong to God. Verse 11, if, however, it is any unclean animal from which they may not offer an offering to the Lord, then he shall cause the animal to stand before the face of the priest, and the priest will make an arrangement for it, whether it's good, whether it's bad. Speaking of the price, not making the price too high or too low for it. According to your arrangement from the priest, thus it shall be. And if someone's really going to redeem it, then he must add a fifth of its value on top of your arrangement. So an animal that couldn't be sacrificed in the temple could be bought back, but you had to pay 120% of its value. Now, in the interest of time, I'm not going to get into verses 15 through 25. They basically say the same thing, applying the same principle to real estate. But there are added complications with that because of the way that the Jubilee cycle affected the values of real estate land, and especially of agricultural land. So it changed from year to year based on the Jubilee cycle. But I want to note a couple things about this passage. And one is that God takes our promises seriously. God takes our promises seriously. He considers to be genuinely His anything that we promise to give to Him. And anything that we actually give Him, He considers His. We can't just take it back. There has been an actual change of ownership if we've given something over to God, and we have to reckon with God as the owner of what was previously ours if we want it back. That seems to be a principle clearly taught in this passage. And this underscores the fact that God is an actual person who can claim ownership over things. God is not some impersonal force that you can donate to and use from at will. He's a person who claims ownership over things and must be reckoned as such. It also underscores the fact that since it is God's character to keep His end of all His promises, it's natural for Him to expect us to keep our end of promises, and that He'll hold us accountable to what we promise. And that's a serious, that's something to reckon with there. God is going to hold you accountable to every promise you make, because He is not only personal, He is also the judge of the universe. The book of Ecclesiastes reminds us, do not be hasty in word or impulsive in thought when you bring up a matter in the presence of God. For God is in heaven, and you are on the earth. Therefore, let your words be few. When you make a vow to the Lord, do not be late in paying it, for He takes no delight in fools. Pay what you vow. It's better that you not vow than that you vow and not pay on it. Don't let your speech cause you to sin, and don't say in the presence of the messenger of God that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry with you on account of your voice and destroy the work of your hands? The wisest man in the world understood the ramifications of a God who will hold you accountable to every promise you make. So God takes our promises seriously. That's the first point that I think is important here for our application. And secondly, not only does God take our promises seriously, He considers it theft to use for yourself anything that you dedicated to Him. You couldn't get your animal back if you chose for your own use if it was a clean animal that you that could be sacrificed and you had given it to the Lord. You couldn't get that back. It belonged to God. Verse 10 says, if you tried to exchange it for another animal, then both animals become holy. Both will get sacrificed. And the same goes with real estate. Verse 20, if you give real estate over to God, you don't get it back in the Jubilee year. You gave it to God. It's His now. Now, for animals, they didn't have any use for at the temple. I suppose even pigs could be dedicated to God. God made everything. Probably pigs were very rarely offered. Can you imagine what happened to any Jew that tried that stunt? You know, you carried it all the way to the temple, but you couldn't go in because you just made yourself unclean because you were carrying a pig. And then everybody else would be kind of looking at you, what kind of idiot was that? What'd he do that for? That was kind of random. The rule in verse 13 for getting back an animal dedicated to God, and we also see that in verses 15, verse 19, getting real estate back that was dedicated to God, was the same rule as restitution for stealing. If you stole something and you made it right, you had to pay 20% on top of the principal. And you don't get to calculate the replacement value either. That role is reserved for a representative of the victim of this robbery. God's the victim, the priest is his representative, and you can bet that priest is going to weight his evaluation in favor of the interest of the temple and not skimp on what you need to pay for that. It's theft to take what has been offered to God and use it for your own purposes. I have worked with a mission agency called the Tent Maker Project, and when our organization first started offering small business loans in Uganda, we had trouble with this very issue, or at least a related issue. The Tent Maker Project came into Uganda, after a difficult civil war, a ravaged economy. People had no economic margin, no savings. And so it was a big deal for a poor church member to receive $100 worth of cash through the Tent Maker Project. And they were told that it all had to be invested in their existing business. You know, we would evaluate their business, and we would, you know, make an assessment as to whether they could handle getting this endowment or loan, and if they really needed it, if it would really help them, and then it would be extended to them through their local church deacons. But as soon as these people would get this cash drop, well, then suddenly, you know, Uncle Stanley comes around and he says, you know, it would be selfish for you to keep all that money. I need to get married. I need hundreds of dollars for my wedding. You need to share with me. And then, you know, Cousin Hannah needs to go to the hospital. I mean, can't deny that. You got to help her with that. And it'd sure be nice to get a radio. And, you know, all these things start, and people were tempted to use the money for illegitimate reasons. And the rumor was even started that if you resigned your membership from the church that it had extended this loan to you, then you wouldn't have to pay back the loan. So one of the ways that we learned to combat this problem was to impress upon these loan recipients that this was not their money. This was the Lord's money, and they would be held accountable by God if they misused it. And the terms of this loan were they had to only spend it on the business purpose that it was approved for, and then they had to pay it back to their church so that other poor people in the church could be assisted. Do you ever handle the Lord's money? Are there any circumstances in your life where you are handling money or property that belongs to the Lord? What about your tithe? Malachi 3 says, do I have the words there? Well, I thought I had Malachi in there somewhere, but maybe not. Malachi 3:8, will a man rob God? And yet you are robbing me. You say, how can we have robbed you? I say, in tithes and offerings. You are cursed with a curse, for you are robbing me, the whole nation of you, says the Lord. Bring the whole tithe into the storehouse so that there may be food in my house. And test me now in this, says the Lord of hosts, if I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you a blessing until it overflows. Then I will rebuke the devourer for you so that it will not destroy the fruits of the ground, nor will your vine in the field cast its grapes, says the Lord of hosts. All the nations will call you blessed then, for you shall live in a delightful land. We can rob God by not taking what belongs to him, the tithe, and actually giving it to him. Now, I must confess, there have been times of economic hardship in my life when I've attempted to rationalize spending tithe money on myself. Well, it's for the poor. I'm giving it to a church pastor. It just happens to be me. or I know I committed a certain amount, more than 10%, but this month I need to just give 10% because I need that extra money. Or everybody else has better benefits or makes more per capita than I do, so I deserve a little indulgence for once. Each of us may rationalize in different ways, but are we being faithful to give God what we promised, or could he accuse us of robbery? He challenges us through the prophet Malachi, just try being faithful with it. Try being a giver. See if you don't experience the riches of great blessing in return. Another couple of principles here, in addition to the principle that God takes our promises seriously and that God considers it theft to use what you have dedicated to him. We see in verse 26, you can't pretend to give to the Lord something that wasn't yours in the first place. Verse 26 makes the point, if something already belongs to the Lord, you can't give it to the Lord. God's already claimed as his own the firstborn of every family and the firstborn of every animal. So these people and animals were considered his from the get-go. They weren't to be considered a gift when you gave them, when you delivered them to the temple. You weren't doing him any kind of favor by giving him your firstborn. They were already his. You could buy your firstborn back, according to the book of Numbers, chapter 3. You buy it back for about 5 shekels, $45. And that's what most people did. But it wasn't yours. You had to buy it back if you wanted it. Furthermore, in verse 28, we see the Israelites reminded that if they had already given something to the Lord, they couldn't use it as though it were theirs. They couldn't sell it. They couldn't get it back in the Jubilee. They lost control of it if they'd given it to God. Verses 28 and 29 list some additional things you couldn't buy back. These things are called cherem in verses 28 and 29. Cherem are devoted things. And generally that meant that they were devoted to destruction. These were not merely voluntary gifts to God. These were actually things that had to be destroyed because God wanted them destroyed. They couldn't be kept in anybody's possession. And examples of this would include the clothes and money that Achan kept for himself after they had sacked the Canaanite city of Jericho. God said, put all those precious metals in the temple treasury and destroy everything else. Canaan took some of the precious metal and took an imported suit, hid it under his own tent. And God punished him and the nation severely as a result of not destroying what God had said must be destroyed, must be cherem, dedicated to destruction. And these most of the things that were cherem were at least initially, before later rabbinical traditions started twisting it and using it for in ways God did not intend, the cherem things tended to be associated with deep idolatry. They had to do with the Canaanite nations that were so given over to idolatry that they were irremediable. They just had to be destroyed. In the case of people who had received the death sentence from a civil court, that was another sort of cherem that could not be redeemed. Or a death sentence from God himself. The Canaanite king Agag was told, Saul captured him alive instead of putting him to death, as God commanded. And God got very angry at him for that. It was one of the key points where Saul lost his inheritance as king as a result of not destroying what God had demanded be destroyed. All these things continue to to point to a God who is personal, a God who determines what is right and wrong, a God who will judge according to that standard of right and wrong and hold people accountable to that, and a God who, you know, who claims exclusive rights. Another one of those exclusive rights was the tithe. And this is kind of how the chapter ends, in verses 30 through 33. In addition to claiming ownership over every person, animal, and piece of real estate that had been promised to him, and in addition to claiming ownership over every firstborn and claiming ownership over certain people and things so enmeshed in rebellion against him that they had to be devoted to destruction, God also claims ownership, in verse 30, over 10% of the profits of every person's farm or orchard or ranch. He says also every tithe of the land, from the seed of the land and from the fruits of the tree, belongs to the Lord. It's holy to the Lord. But if a man really wants to redeem some of his tithe, he must add its fifth on top of it. And every tenth of the herd and of the flock and all that pass underneath the counting rod, the tenth will be holy to the Lord. He must not search out the good instead of the bad. He must not exchange any. If he really makes an exchange, it'll come to pass that both it and its exchange will become holy. It may not be redeemed. The Jews developed a custom based on this to funnel their herds. Not the whole herd, just all the animals born that year through a cattle gate. And tap each tenth animal on the back with a rod that was dipped in an ochre red dye, and this kind of randomized the choice of animals. They could then round up all the red dotted sheep or cows and herd them off to the Levites. And that seems to be supported by what it says in verse 33 about not cherry picking what you give to the Lord. Notice, God doesn't command the Israelites to give that 10%. He just says, it was mine. He just claims it and expects to see it delivered. I don't remember if I'm getting ahead of myself or not, but because the tithe was not instituted by Moses, it was instituted back in Genesis. It was practiced by God's people back in Genesis. It was brought back up in the Mosaic Law. Jesus brings it back up, says, "Yeah, you should do that. You should tithe." This is a standard of worshiping God. It is a way that God has taught us to worship him. It doesn't have to be limited to 10%, but it is a way that God has taught us to worship him, and it's still valid for us today. So as we look at this whole chapter, I want to kind of just recap three points, three applications. One of them is that it's quite appropriate for us to make promises and to dedicate things to the Lord. Quite appropriate to give a special gift to the Lord, especially if we're thankful for something he's done. We see that the David does that in the Psalm 116. We see the prophet Jonah down in the stomach of the fish under the Mediterranean Ocean, drowning to death. And he says, God, if you'll just deliver me from this, I will make a special sacrifice at the temple. That was appropriate. It was fine. And God did deliver him. King Hezekiah, when he had a terminal illness, he said, God, I promise I'll make up a special song and sing it in the temple with my guitar if you'll just heal me. And that was entirely appropriate. Even in the New Testament, we see Ananias and Sapphira promising to give the proceeds of their land to the apostle. It was not that promise which got them killed. It was their failure to make good on their promise that got them killed. there was nothing wrong with them offering the proceeds of their land. And Paul, Peter actually affirmed that. He said, there's nothing wrong with giving. It was the fact that you promised and didn't deliver. We also see Zacchaeus making things right from his lifetime of corruption by promising to give half of his goods to the poor. He was so glad that Jesus had saved him. He wanted to make right all the wrongs he'd done. And what does Jesus say? Oh, no, you shouldn't give half of your stuff away. No, no, Zacchaeus. No, Jesus said, hey, this tax collector is a real son of Abraham. Way to go, Zacchaeus. Jesus affirmed making a promise like that. So if you find yourself wanting to give a special gift to God, that's right. That's fine. That's good. In fact, if you don't ever find yourself wanting to give anything special to the Lord, you probably ought to ask yourself, why don't I? Is there something wrong in my heart? And then if there is anything you have promised to God that you haven't made good on yet, well, now's the time to do it. Now, a second application of this is that we need to be careful when we make a promise, because we are going to be held accountable to God for every promise we make. So we need to be careful not to be careless with our words. Gordon Wenham in the New International Commentary on the Old Testament on this chapter wrote, it may well be part of the purpose of this chapter to discourage rash swearing by fixing a relatively high price for the discharge of the vows and for penalizing those who change their minds. Oh, actually wanted that animal back. Oh, no, you don't get that animal back. You lose two animals. Penalizing. One doesn't have to go much further in biblical history from Leviticus to take in the horror of Jephthah, the judge, promising to sacrifice to God the first thing that came out of the gate to greet him when he came back victorious from battle. And then he gets there and realizes, oh no, it's my own daughter that's the first one out of the gate to greet me. We got to be careful not to make a careless promise to God, because God will hold us accountable. There were problems with that story, but I won't get into that. It does illustrate that we need to be careful what we promise. In the New Testament, we see the Pharisees abusing this very Corban law to place all their belongings under the management of the temple so that they could have a convenient excuse not to provide for their elderly parents. Jesus criticized them, said, what you're doing is wrong. Sure, you're obeying the terms of Leviticus 27 by offering Corban gifts to the Lord, but you're violating the heart of this. You're violating the commandment to honor your parents when you do that. You've got to be careful what you dedicate to the Lord, because God may have other purposes for what you own and what he has given you as resources. We need to examine our attitudes towards giving so we're not misusing the resources God has given us. The psalmist prayed, set a guard, O Lord, over my mouth. Keep watch over the door of my lips. If you have a problem with making careless promises, that's a good verse to memorize. Set a guard, O Lord, over my mouth. Keep watch over the words of my lips, over the door of my lips. And then a third application here. This chapter raises the question of whether there is anything which belongs to God, which you are using as though it's your own. Repentance would mean turning away from using what is God's for your own purposes, and make sure that what is God's, God really has full access to, and you're not trying to control. In the tithe, God lays a claim to your profit margin. Are you giving that percentage of your profit margin to him? Or are you using for yourself what belongs to God? There's the place in the sermon where I was going to talk about it having it not being just limited to the Levitical law. We see Abraham giving a tithe to a Jebusite priest in Genesis 14. We see Jacob giving a tithe in Genesis 28, long before Moses. And then there's the actual quote from Jesus. He says, "Y'all are tithing your mint and your dill and your cumin, and it's necessary to do these things. Yet y'all are letting go of the weightier matters of the law: justice, mercy, faithfulness. Shouldn't have let those things go." Justice, mercy, and faith also belong to God. God isn't just looking for you to legalistically pay 10%. He's looking for the right attitude as well: justice, mercy, and faithfulness. In fact, God claims your whole body. 1 Corinthians 6 says, "Do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit who's in you, whom you have from God, and that you are not your own?" Your body doesn't belong to you. It belongs to God. "You were bought at a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body and in your spirit, because they belong to God." Again, how does that affect the way that you will use your own body? In Romans 12, you know, offer your own selves as a living sacrifice to the Lord. Well, this ends the book of Leviticus. It's a little bit anticlimactic. The book of Numbers follows with the word and describes a census of the men eligible for army duty, and off it goes from there. I hope that as we have looked at this sweep of the book of Leviticus, from the different kinds of sacrifices by which God provided for us to be acceptable to Him, by which God provided for sin to be atoned for, and guilt to be removed, the standards for how to make a temple holy, how to make a priesthood, what priests were supposed to do, what God's representatives were supposed to do, what does it mean to serve God, and all of the laws regarding holiness. What does it mean to set apart your life? What kind of claims does God have on your life? And how does he make us different from the world? And how do we become more like him? Because that is the heart of holiness, is being conformed to what he is like. I hope that all of these things have been helpful in growing you and your personal relationship with God, because you know, this is the stuff of personal relationship with God. May God continue to grow us in our personal relationship with Him, growing us in His holiness, making us more like Him.